The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There are rare instances of altering votes, like in Eastern Europe in the immediate post-war period or the targeting of Ukrainian electoral systems in 2014, but really this is a tradition of manipulating minds, and Russia did that throughout our country for months, and through the threat of another type of interference of disrupting the voting process through reports that, you know, Michael Daniel, the cybersecurity coordinator in the White House, told me he was getting daily reports in August of intrusions and penetrations into our electoral infrastructure, was coming in on a ceaseless basis that captivated and ultimately froze our government as Russia's influence campaign was raging. So that to me is the most essential sort of lens through which to understand what happened in our government in that time. And then there were assumptions that also mattered there, which is that their worst case scenario was that Russia would sabotage voter databases on election day, throw our country into chaos because people wouldn't be able to vote. Trump would lose. He would say it was rigged. He would point to anonymous discrepancies because Russia's hand would be hidden in saying, the election was rigged against me and sort of turn the country against the result and thereby delegitimize our democratic process, which is Putin's objective.
I'm Jack Goldsmith, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 3rd, 2020. I spoke with David Shimer, the author of Rigged, America, Russia, and 100 Years of Covert Electoral Interference. We discussed United States and Soviet interference in elections during the Cold War, how and why the U.S. attitude towards foreign electoral interference changed after the Cold War, and whether and to what degree the Central Intelligence Agency still covertly intervenes in foreign elections today. We also discuss how the rise of the internet asymmetrically empowers Russia in its long-term efforts to disrupt domestic U.S. politics. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 3rd, Rigged. David Shimer, thanks for joining us. What is covert electoral interference?
Right. Well, yeah, thank you first and foremost so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And what covert electoral interference is, which is sort of the grounding, the focus of my book, is it can be broken down into three components. And those are the three words, covert, electoral, and interference. So an operation is covert if the hand of the interfering actor is hidden or unattributable. So a public endorsement, for example, by a leader of another leader is not covert. So that doesn't count. But if you steal files from someone and release them through a third party, so that way your hand is hidden, that qualifies as covert. And therefore, you're sort of still in the ballgame, so to speak. So the second component is electoral. For something to be an electoral operation, it needs to be targeting a vote that determines another country's leader. So if you are just seeking to influence people in general, so if you're just sorting to influence debate over a policy issue, doesn't count. It needs to be geared toward an electoral process and therefore seeking to manipulate the process of succession of another country. And then the third component is interference. And what that means is you are deploying, so-called active measures. You're seeking to influence, not just to collect. You're not just spying on people. You are seeking to manipulate them or their infrastructure in order to change the trajectory of a country. And therefore, the overarching definition I use is a concealed foreign effort to manipulate a democratic process of succession. So when you meet those three qualifications, covert electoral interference, then you basically fit the definition that that ground the types of operations that I analyze in the 100-year history that I go through in my book.
Great. So the second half or second third of the book is about the 2016 electoral interference by the Russians. But the first half to two-thirds of the book, as you just suggested, is about the kind of prehistory to that, which is fascinating and puts what happened in 2016 in perspective. And maybe surprising or not, I don't know, to our listeners, the United States had a pretty aggressive role in covert electoral interference during the Cold War. So let's start with, I guess it's the event that began it all for the United States. And this event, as you say, is well known, although you add some interesting details. And that is the CIA's, I think, first covert action, which is the electoral interference in Italy in the 1940s. Is that right?
Right. So that is the beginning of the American story. So a little bit of background right before then, the Soviet story here had been ongoing for about 30 years. Vladimir Lenin, when he founded an international organization known as the Communist International in 1919, united the communist parties of the world, or sought to, and then started giving them money, giving them advice, helping them spread propaganda. Very primitive and rather ineffective operations to interfere in elections, but all the same, they were in existence. The road to Italy then starts, where after the Second World War, the Soviet Union aggressively manipulates elections across Eastern Europe, as is pretty well known, in countries like Poland, East Germany, and Hungary, with tactics and tools that are eerily, in many ways, reminiscent of what Russia used in 2016 and is currently using to interfere in elections all over the world. Just one used the internet and one didn't. In 1947, as these Eastern European elections were effectively rigged, the Truman administration viewed Italy sort of as the upcoming battleground, where if we lost, or if the U.S. lost Italy to Soviet influence, that would be unacceptable. So what Truman did was he authorized the CIA to engage in covert action, first formal authorization in the history of the agency, in order to launch a massive covert electoral operation against Italy's election in order to solidify and bolster the centrist Christian Democrats in their competition with the Italian Communist Party.
And one of the interesting things about the book is, well, several things about the Italian election. We'll talk about it. It was kind of the template, as I think someone in the CIA called it, for what came later. But talk about how the extent to which, you know, U.S. officials who were running this had scruples about it. Because one of the interesting things about your book is your documentation of the way that American scruples changed about this stuff. What was the attitude in the late 40s?
Totally. So you're right. I mean, it's quite ironic. There were very few. I would say that I could almost find no evidence that American officials were hesitant, or that there was even much debate about whether this was a good idea. I mean, it was a different world in 1948 for a couple of reasons. The United States wasn't vulnerable in any meaningful way to these sorts of operations. So that idea of blowback mattered less. There was also, you know, you're 2.5-3 years out of the Second World War, Italy being one of the countries against which you fought. The way CIA officers whom I was able to interview in the Cold War phrased it is, if you could determine the trajectory of Italy without losing any lives and not actually even spending that much money, why wouldn't we do that? So, it, you know, there's this odd conception, I think, that for the CIA to say to these old CIA officers, oh, you interfered in elections, that it's sort of a gotcha moment. And that's what I sort of expected at first. I was able to interview 8 former CIA directors and many more former CIA officers. But in fact, it's the opposite. When you ask them about operations like in Italy, there's unmistakable pride. That was us at our best, and which is, I think, quite uncomfortable for many people when they sort of, I imagine it will be when they read that, because today, covert electoral interference is viewed as something that's unacceptable and something we need to push back against, which I believe it is. But during the Cold War, and especially among these old CIA Cold Warriors, there is not regret, so to speak, in terms of, for example, what the CIA did in Italy.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, you have some wonderful quotes from William Colby, who I think ran the operation, and who later became CIA director, really at a time when the CIA started to rethink this after Chile, which we'll get to in a second. I mean, he speaks about it in moral terms. The end sought must be in defense of the security of the state, acting not for aggression or aggrandizement, and the means used must be only those needed to accomplish that end, not excessive ones. In this moral and philosophical framework, assistance to democratic groups in Italy to enable them to meet the Soviet-supported subversive campaign there can certainly be accepted as a moral act.
No, exactly. I think there was a feeling among individuals like Kolbe and his fellow travelers that the CIA was the good guys. And that was how they saw the world. And therefore, if they could engage in Italian politics to make sure that more good guys won, from their perspective, that was something that they could do, that they should do. And as it sounds like we'll talk about, that they then aggressively did seek to do, not only in Italy's 1948 election, but in Italian elections for more than two decades, in which they spent the equivalent of more than $500 million seeking to influence and interfere in Italian elections.
Yeah. When they say one of the amazing things about this book, as you alluded to, is how many intelligence officers from the Central Intelligence Agency, and even Clinton, I was amazed with some of the things he told you, Bill Clinton, you have them on the record talking about these covert operations. And I want to talk about that more in the end. But you have the historian, the chief historian of the CIA, David Robarge. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah, that's right.
You have him saying that the 40s action, this covert operation in Italy was, I think he used the word, a template for everything that followed. So tell us about the template.
Sure. So I would say there were two tracks to the CIA's operation in Italy that is foundational to understanding the CIA's approach to electoral interference and really to just covert electoral interference in general. The first track was just money. Which was, we are going to get millions of dollars to the Christian Democrats so that the Christian Democrats could campaign more effectively, could reach more voters, and therefore could influence more voters in the lead up to the election. So the CIA was able to funnel what David Robarge described as several million dollars to the Christian Democratic Party in the lead up to the election in 1948. The second track had to do with the spreading of propaganda, of campaign initiatives that the CIA could bolster and enhance. And the trick here is that very rarely, and this extends for decades, that typically that means enhancing overt mechanisms. So it's not as though a covert propaganda operation is just operating all by its lonesome, because what Robarge explained and what others have explained who I was able to interview is that it's actually much more effective when you just make something that already exists sort of, you know, even better. So the Catholic Church, for instance, was very involved in opposing the communists in Italy in 1948. And what Robarge said is that the CIA, you know, gave the Catholic Church infrastructure, advice, support, funding, anything that could be used to make it so the Catholic Church could then reach more Italians more effectively and more precisely, because Italians would be much more likely to be receptive to influence and advice coming from, you know, a local religious authority than a foreign entity. And the other thing that the CIA did, extraordinarily, is that they helped orchestrate something known as a letter writing campaign, which is a couple of key influential Italian Americans, one Generoso Pope, who was the owner of the largest Italian American newspaper in the United States. He started asking his readers to send letters back home to Italy to their friends, to their relatives, saying you have to oppose the communists. And that was a huge moment, because what that was people being reached, Italians being reached based on who they were, who they knew, what their interests were, and therefore they'd be more likely to actually have their opinions changed from that contact. And what Robarge and I discussed is that the CIA came up with the idea for the letter writing initiative and fortified and enhanced it as it was ongoing. And an estimated 10 million messages ended up being sent back into Italy in the lead up to the 1948 election. So, you know, when we talk today about reaching voters across social media, for example, based on their personal profiles, that was really hard to do before the internet existed. It only happened very rarely. One time where it did happen was with this letter writing campaign, where you would have, you know, one brother send to another brother a letter asking them to oppose the communist base that was personalized and intimate, and American officials on the ground at the time believed it was extraordinarily effective.
Yeah, and speaking of, you just compared that campaign to social media. One of the remarkable things to me was how the Soviets, as you say, had been trying to interfere in American elections going very far back. But my read of your book is they weren't terribly successful before the internet era. Is that right?
That's exactly right. The ideas were there. The intentions were there. I one of the more clarifying interviews I did was with a former KGB general who worked for the KGB for about four decades, who was its youngest ever general and was stationed in the U.S. for quite a while. And the way he described to me what the Soviet Union tried to do in the U.S., it sounded as if it could be what, you know, one of Vladimir Putin's advisors was saying today. They were seeking to advantage the candidates they liked, undermine the one they didn't, and above all, to sow discord. And they tried to do that in various ways. They attempted to collude directly with two different nominees for president.
Please talk about those episodes because it's a nice contrast to 2016.
Yeah, no, in 1960. And by the way, a key point here that I really feel strongly about, we talk about this as a partisan issue, covert electoral interference, because, you know, it evidently helps Republicans and hurts Democrats in 16. Well, in 1960, the Soviet Union wanted to help Democrats and hurt Republicans because covert electoral interference is not a partisan issue. It has to do with the interests of the interfering actor. And at that time, Nikita Khrushchev, who is the head of the Soviet Union, thought that it was in his interest to hurt Richard Nixon and to therefore get who was the Republican nominee or the presumptive Republican nominee and to help the Democrats. So he approached through his ambassador, perhaps the previous Democratic nominee, Adlai Stevenson, and sent him a letter directly that was read to him out loud to Stevenson that said, "Tell us what we can do to help you. We want to help you. We want you to be president." And Adlai Stevenson was so alarmed by this that he not only said at the time, "This is untoward, irresponsible, and reckless," he then memorialized the interaction in a memo to himself because he was so nervous, evidently, that this could somehow be sort of, I think, used against him. And he said, "You know, I rejected the offer, and I then wrote a letter to the ambassador afterward reiterating that I would not accept their assistance." And then a very similar thing happened 8 years later, where Hubert Humphrey was the Democratic nominee, the sitting vice president. Again, the Soviet ambassador had a one-on-one meeting with him and was instructed to say to Humphrey that the Soviet Union wanted to basically fund his campaign. And as the ambassador started to try to articulate that, Humphrey cut him off and just said, "You know, having your good wishes is good enough for me." And that ended the advance. So what you saw there were two politicians who drew a very, you know, distinct line in saying, I will not allow a foreign actor to covertly manipulate the sovereignty of my democracy, even if it would benefit me," which, of course, it contrasts starkly with our current moment. But there were other tactics, and I could talk more about that, of interest that were very reminiscent of what Russia does in general, such as trying to sow racial discord, such as spreading propaganda that outs the private lives of public figures in order to, you know, try to ruin their political careers or candidacies. What Putin did in 16, every single one of his tactics can be traced back to the Soviet era. They were just enhanced and juiced up because of what the internet lent him.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Let's talk about what I view from your book as the turning point in the U.S. attitude towards electoral interference by the United States, and that's the case of Chile. Could you just walk us through basically the electoral interference, the attempted coup, and how that led to changed attitudes in the United States, if I've characterized it correctly?
Sure, and I agree with almost everything you said, and basically is that the Chile story, I think many Americans are familiar with the 1973 coup that ultimately resulted in the death of Salvador Allende, who was a socialist, who was the president of Chile, who the U.S. worked against at the time. But what I think has been often lost by history is that the U.S. had spent about a decade seeking to keep Allende out of power through electoral operations. So in 1964, the U.S. launched, I would say this was perhaps the peak moment in the CIA's history of covert electoral interference, a massive and astoundingly, you know, large relative to the size of Chile operation based on those two tracks I described, funding the campaign of Allende's opponent and spreading enormous amounts of propaganda to defeat Allende in the 64 election. You actually ended up having the CIA fund more than half of the overall budget of its preferred campaign with $3 million, which was more than, and spent more than $3 million, which was more than the number of Chileans who actually voted in the election. So this was an extraordinarily large operation. And again, in that instance, Allende lost, just like the Italian communists lost. So the CIA assumed that it was their work that led to the outcome, that led to their opponents losing. This is not something that can ever really be proven, but it was the presumption, it was the perception inside Washington. What then happened in 1970 was there was a lack of focus, resolve, and investment from the perspective of Washington in the Chilean election in that year, in which Salvador Allende was running again. Henry Kissinger, who was the national security advisor at the time, later wrote in his memoirs that he regretted not offering to launch, you know, a more aggressive covert electoral interference operation because it was, compared to 1964, not as aggressive. Allende ends up winning the election, which astounds and shocks Richard Nixon and sends him into a panic, where he then orders Richard Helms, who was the director of the CIA, to foment a coup in Chile and to prevent Salvador Allende from being confirmed as president. So first, the CIA tried to buy votes so that way Allende wouldn't be confirmed, because that was the next stage in the Chilean political process. Congressional lawmakers would vote to confirm him. They were going to try to buy votes because that is another form of electoral interference, but it didn't work. It was too sort of wide ranging and too implausible. So then they transitioned to coup plotting, which ended up resulting in the death of a Chilean general who had said he would stand by an Allende administration. But in the end, Allende was in fact confirmed. And what this offers is a really interesting insight into the choice that foreign leaders have to make when their covert operations to interfere in elections fail. Because in 1970, Nixon didn't get his way. Allende was elected, and he had to then decide, do I proceed to another form of covert action, which is coup plotting? Because something that's very important here is that covert operations to foment coups, that's a different thing than a covert operation to interfere in an election. And Nixon did make that choice. He decided to transition to staging a coup. And ultimately, a few years later in 1973, after sort of relentless CIA efforts to undermine the Allende administration, the Chilean military did stage a coup and did overthrow his government. But that was sort of the end of a very long story of the CIA's involvement in Chilean politics regarding Allende. And in terms of it being a turning point, what that did is once it was outed, a year or two later, you had reforms installed around oversight, around, you know, the finding process where presidents had to notify Congress of covert action programs, key congressional leaders of these programs. And it's a turning point in the sense that it didn't lead these operations to stop, as I'm sure we'll talk about, but it did make it so that sort of the way Robars described it to me, the broad net of CIA operations to interfere in elections in, let's say, countries all over the world, that stopped after the Chilean operation. And it became a much more targeted process when there were specific elections in which the CIA was sort of authorized to engage in by the president, they would. But it's not as though the CIA was interfering in, you know, 50 elections at the same time at that point. And that's a number that I'm just making up, but my point being that it becomes a much more targeted and precise process when there's a specific call to action because of that new oversight and accountability that had not existed at all prior to that Church and Pike era.
Right. So before we get to that, I just want to underscore one thing that stuck out to me. So the United States does interfere in the election in the 60s. They get their candidate. They don't interfere successfully. They don't put a lot of resource into it in the 70s. They lose. And then they turn to try to unwind the consequences of the Democratic election. And then that goes badly, and then it blows up in their face publicly. My sense was that that's when questions, scruples started being raised by this point, independent of, obviously, and bolstered by Church and Pike and all the other revelations of the 70s and the kind of hemming in and advances in accountability for the CIA. My sense was that starting around then, people started asking, how can we fight for democracy abroad and promote democracy abroad if we're going to be interfering in democratic outcomes? So my sense was that the questions started to be raised more by the early 70s than they were, say, in the late 40s. Is that right?
So I think that's true, but I view the turning point much more as the end of the Cold War than this 1975 period. I do not think it's accurate. Maybe more scruples were being raised, but the CIA was still interfering in elections in the late 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, I agree. And it was also interfering in elections after the Cold War, as we'll get to. But exactly. I thought there was something in your book where you said that the coup itself, as opposed to the other forms of electoral interference, that's kind of that the question whether a coup to reverse a democratic election was something we could really really stand by the same way we had.
Yeah, I mean, it was on American. And I think the thing about the coup plotting that makes it so awful and so sort of not aligned with the other examples we'll discuss is that in all the other cases, like in Italy or later, as we'll talk about in Serbia, the idea was to support candidates who would uphold democracy. And that was the justification. That's what Colby told himself, that we're interfering against the people who would topple democracies. But in Chile, the U.S. actually worked to topple a democracy. So if that contradicted really the stated justification for these operations and served as sort of the glaring outlier that I think you're right, made a lot of folks uncomfortable and made a lot of folks more hesitant about sort of the result of so aggressively interfering in the politics of other states.
Okay, let's talk about the Cold War, the end of the Cold War, and what that did to the American practice of covert electoral interference.
Sure. So what happens in the cold with the end of the Cold War is, just thinking logically, during the Cold War, the CIA wanted to contain communism and the Soviet Union wanted to spread communism. So, or just leftist candidates in general. So that led to so many opportunities and so many motivating contests to get involved and interfere in elections, right? So, I mean, all over the world. So it makes sense that both intelligence services were involved. What happens after the Cold War is that call to action is gone, and it's replaced by calls from folks like Bill Clinton and others saying, you know, we are transitioning from containing communism to promoting democracy as an end in itself. And when that becomes the objective, interfering in an election covertly, which is inherently undemocratic in the sense that it violates the sovereignty of another democracy, became a much not only riskier proposition, but also much less aligned with America's foreign policy objectives. So what you see after the Cold War is less of a call to action. And then that, coupled with the advent of the internet, which, and I could explain the reasons why that makes this an even worse policy option for America, made covert electoral interference something that became simultaneously much less appealing to the United States and much more appealing to Putin's Russia.
So we'll get to the internet in a second, but let's talk about the, I guess it was a combined overt and covert operation in Serbia in 2000. But now this is after the Cold War, and I think this is the only example of an actual covert operation, covert electoral interference operation by the United States that you mentioned. There's the Iraq case that we'll discuss, but I don't think that was followed through.
Yeah, so that wasn't followed through. And yeah, I was very lucky. I was able to... I talked to some CIA officers who were willing to discuss this and then was able to interview Bill Clinton, and he confirmed it, which is that he authorized the CIA in 2000 to work against Slobodan Milosevic, who was the Yugoslav leader, who was also a war criminal and a tyrant. And what the CIA did was provide money and support to the opposition. So way back, thinking back to Italy, same idea, just getting money so the campaign can, you know, reach people more effectively, influence voters more effectively. And what one CIA officer told me is that, you know, they basically would just give them cash on the spot outside of their country's borders, handoffs, so that they could then take that money and use it to fund their campaign. But the key distinction here that Clinton drew, and that's important, is twofold. One, that this was an exceptional case, that Milosevic's atrocities were so extraordinary that he was set to manipulate his election in his favor, that from the perspective of the U.S., to interfere in this election in order to get sort of, you know, what Clinton called someone responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths who had caused so much destruction out of office was inherently appealing. And the second thing is that the CIA did not spread disinformation or false information knowingly, nor did it seek to manipulate actual vote tallies. And that was a distinction that Clinton drew very, very purposefully and intentionally when I talked to him. So there were lines being drawn in terms of how far the CIA would go. But in this instance, and I would argue an exception rather than the rule, the U.S. did covertly interfere in an election in the post-Cold War period in order to work against Milosevic.
I was surprised to read about this. Was this covert action known before your book?
My understanding is, I mean, I don't want to say categorically no, because
did you read about it before this?
No, I hadn't. I mean, I'd seen in one article in like the Washington Post that they kind of said in one sentence, like there were rumors that the CIA might be involved in the election, but But no, I don't. My understanding is that this is the first time this operation has ever been publicly acknowledged.
Yes. And by the president of the United States himself, Clinton.
Yeah, no, that was a huge boon.
You don't take normative stance. Well, I guess you do a little bit at the end. So what do you think about the exception for Milosevic in the post-Cold War period? Do you think, I mean, it seems to me to be a hard case because we're fighting for democracy and it is the post-Cold War period. The justification of the evil Soviet Union is gone. I guess there's a replacement for the evil Soviet Union that gives the justification. Were you persuaded by Clinton's answer?
I would say that I understand why this felt like an exceptional case, what the rationale for doing it was, just in order to give the opposition to Milosevic, I guess, you know, a shot. However, I would also argue that if Clinton were presented with this option, if he were the president in 2020 rather than in 2000, the decision would look a lot different. And so what I do feel sure of is that if it were 2020, I would say this is not something the U.S. should do.
Well, but that's because of the interference in our election, right? What about if it were 2015?
I would still say because of our own, A, because of our own vulnerabilities, and B, because because of this digital era, I think that it's much easier for us to, or much more plausible and safe for us to interfere overtly. Because, by the way, I didn't mention this, there was a massive overt effort to influence the Serbian election involving democracy promotion organizations, the State Department, and other U.S. government agencies. And to me, if you're working against a tyrannical figure like Milosevic, I think overt influence, overt involvement is that makes sense to me, because what you're doing there is you're showing the hand of the United States. Serbian voters can know, okay, America is seeking to influence us and we can decide how to interpret that and how to act. The problem with covert action with regard to elections is that it hides America's hand. And if discovered, it therefore can serve to legitimize the very type of behavior that we're seeking to prevent by bad actors or by actors like Russia who are targeting our own election. So to me, overt action should against figures like Milosevic is a much better road. And in general, in cases not involving figures like Milosevic, I don't think we should be interfering in elections at all.
Well, let me just press you on the overt versus covert distinction, because it's definitely one that I think it's people who focus on these things believe that overt influence on a foreign election is much less problematic normatively, morally, than covert, precisely for the reasons you said, that it's not as misleading and it can be dealt with openly. But think about the 2016 election. I mean, I guess that was technically a covert operation by the Russians, but they didn't take great steps to hide it. And by July, I think it was June or July, everyone understood that it was a Russian operation. And we still thought it was deeply inappropriate for them to be breaking into emails and to using social media and the like. So I'm not completely convinced by the overt versus covert, one being okay and one not being okay. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I understand your point, but I would push back on the notion that Russia's operation wasn't covert, because yes, parts of it were attributed in near real time, but because it wasn't just, you know, Russia, the Russian government uploading, let's say, the DNC emails, but rather WikiLeaks, that led to opportunities to sow immense discord and immense distrust in American society, because you could have the U.S. government saying, as they did in October, that this is the Russian government, but then you could have a political figure in Donald Trump saying that's not true, it was WikiLeaks. So even if you're attributing a covert operation in real time, there's no telling that your electorate will actually believe what the government is saying or who's behind it. And in some ways for Russia, it actually served the Russian objective for their covert operations to be partially attributed as they're unfolding, because it just serves to cause chaos. But I would be much more comfortable if, let's say, you know, Putin were just saying, I think you should vote for Donald Trump over Joe Biden, or other types of overt action in that sense. Okay, then every American can see that and understand that. But if Putin is spreading social media propaganda through trolls and bots that purport to be Americans but are actually Russians, to me, that is completely subversive to the democratic processes and is corrupting our debate in a way that Americans have no way to understand at the time, because these accounts appear to belong to actual Americans.
So I accept all of that. Let me just push you one more time.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I agree that the social media stuff was not acknowledged and not attributed to Russia for the most part during the campaign. But you do make the point that, you know, even when it was kind of in the news attributed to the Russians, no one cared about that. They were focused on the details, especially of the Panetta stuff, the sordid details of what his email said about the Democratic Party backing Clinton over Sanders and things like that. So my question is, imagine, and I agree, there was some uncertainty, so I accept everything you said, but I'm just asking, in the 2016 election, if Putin does the same thing, but instead of posting it on WikiLeaks, he posted on the, you know, Internet Research, some Soviet website saying, look what we found, and it causes massive disruption because it's telling information that affects voter preferences. Is that okay? I understand why covert is bad. I just don't understand where we draw the line about overt and why it's not just as bad.
No, I mean, I think you make a great point, and I think that's also bad. I don't think that we should allow for him to do that, because that also involves the deployment or the theft and release of private information. And maybe that makes it problematic, not because it's overt, but because it's a violation of someone's private life. And
it's a crime. It's a crime, to be fair.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but so I think there are forms, I mean, maybe to really nitpick this, I think there are forms of overt involvement that feel more comfortable and more morally acceptable than stealing and releasing information belonging to, you know, an American or to a citizen of a country. I think that if Russia were to do like hold a rally, or if, you know, with Donald Trump or something, which I don't think Trump would actually want, that to me would be a lot more toward the acceptable, because everyone can see that. Whereas like what you're saying, which would be a crime, I understand it's not covert, but I don't think that makes it okay. So I think if we're trying to see what is actually in and out of bounds, I think to me, covert action by the U.S. to interfere in election at this point is out of bounds. I think crimes are out of bounds. But I think that, for example, endorsing, you know, the Remain campaign and the Brexit referendum, that to me didn't feel inherently problematic.
So let's talk about what I think is one of the most interesting parts of this very interesting book. And that is, you asked a lot of people who spoke to you on the record from the intelligence services, whether the United States still participates in covert electoral interference. And you got two types of answers. Talk to us about that.
Sure. So, yeah, I sort of made sure, because, you know, the question for me is, how can you actually try to get to some semblance of the truth here? And that's through reporting. That's through asking as many people as possible, either on the record or on background, what's the state of play? So I did that with the CIA directors, deputy directors, DNIs, with whom I was able to meet. And what I found was that one group of folks, like David Petraeus, like John Brennan, like Michael Morell, and David Cohen, who said that in more recent times, the CIA doesn't do this full stop. You know, they spoke in absolutes and said, the CIA has turned the page. We don't do it anymore. We don't interfere in elections. And the line Brennan drew was from George W. Bush onward. The second group of individuals wouldn't speak in absolutes. They would say, either there wasn't much of it, which is what John McLaughlin, who was the deputy director from 2000 to 2004, said, or they would draw sort of fine lines as to what we do and don't do. Like Avril Haines said we don't tamper with votes. That's something that she drew a line on. So that was her sort of absolute statement. But other officials also said that these subjects are still raised. Like Tony Blinken said that in the Obama administration, ideas to interfere in elections covertly would still come up. They would just get rejected. So the ideas are still there. And perhaps the most forthcoming individual was Leon Panetta, who did describe a form of that Italy model, where you have covert influence efforts complementing overt propaganda campaigns in order to, you know, shift the messaging in a country or get a message out in a country by influencing foreign media, which he described as a very rare occurrence and as something that would be used in exceptional circumstances. But based on his description from his time at CIA, that was something that he was involved in. So it's, again, very difficult to put a fine point on. And I have a feeling that these discrepancies in large part have to do with differing definitions among these different CIA figures as to what they're actually talking about. Because even though I do define it, I think that everybody has their own sort of definition. But I would say my overarching conclusion is that the CIA right now is in a very tense position, which is that it has not banned the practice of covert electoral interference, but it is an option that is not actually executed with great frequency. And that is different than the Cold War, but it's also different than saying this is something that the U.S. categorically will not do anymore, which is not where things are. I actually have, or had in the book, folks like Harry Reid, Leon Panetta, and John McLaughlin arguing that the CIA should actually start interfering in more elections to counter Russia's operation. So this is by no means a settled question. It's just not 1960 anymore.
Yeah. So let me just, this is, again, I think one of the most fascinating parts of the book. You also have Clapper saying that it's all a question of degree, which I took to mean that we still do some things related to foreign elections that might be deemed interference, maybe related to propaganda operations, he doesn't say, but maybe we don't do other things. But listen to some of the things Panetta said. You say, Panetta, you quote, former CIA director, on rare occasions, the CIA did influence foreign media outlets ahead of key elections in order to, quote, change attitudes within the country, unquote. The CIA's method, Panetta went on, was to, quote, acquire media within a country or within a region that could very well be used for being able to deliver specific messages, end quotes, or work to quote, influence those that may own elements of the media to be able to cooperate, work with you in delivering that message, unquote. That sounds to me not unlike what the Soviet Union, what the Russians were doing with social media in 2016.
Well, I think the difference based on what he was describing is that, A, that he also said he never touched disinformation or never touched spreading false information. Mm-hmm. And B, my impression was that he was talking more about traditional news outlets than social media platforms, which is more in line with what the agency had done historically. But I agree. I think that what he was alluding to is the persistence of the idea that the CIA can be influencing attitudes in a country. And I think that my sense, and this isn't just from Panetta, this is sort of generally from my research, is that that question of degree to which Clapper was alluding is if the CIA were to, for example, spread propaganda that is in support of the policies of someone like Rouhani in Iran, and that is because the America wants his policies to be advanced, but there happens to be an Iranian election coming up. Does that therefore qualify as electoral interference? Because if you're spreading propaganda that aligns with his policy objectives, you're necessarily then spreading propaganda that aligns with his standing politically. So if I had to guess, and I want to be clear that that is not something that I know for certain, especially regarding Iran, that was just an example in my mind. But that is what they're talking about, which is very different from what Russia's doing, which is targeting voting systems, hacking and releasing stolen information to sabotage campaigns and spreading disinformation across social media platforms in a systemic way. So I wouldn't say that what Panetta's describing is equivalent at all to what Russia's doing, but I also wouldn't say that what Panetta's describing doesn't qualify as covert electoral interference because it does.
Yeah, I was suggesting not that, obviously it's not, I wasn't saying the two were equal. I guess I'm just trying to understand how the intelligence services are thinking about these things. Propaganda has been a traditional covert operation since the beginning. It can obviously affect electoral politics. And I was thinking more that what Panetta was describing sounded not like the doxing operation against the DNC, but a little bit like, except in social media rather than traditional news outlets, a little bit like, and on a lesser scale perhaps, the use of social media to spread a message.
Yeah, no, I found it really interesting. And it's especially interesting because, as I said, you know, in the Cold War, the KGB also was interfering in elections all over the world, which was the initial call to action for the CIA to respond in kind. But the more interesting thing here now is that up until recently, really 15, 16, so Panetta was CIA director from 09 to 11, there wasn't that systemic call to action in the sense that Russia was not yet systemically interfering in elections all over the world in support of its new strategy. So it was a very interesting time for the U.S. to be influencing media, if it were covertly, because it wouldn't have been in responding, as has been the case in the past, to sort of a threat, if that makes sense. It was sort of there for on our own initiative.
Right. Okay, let's turn to 2016. I want to start off by asking you about the kind of prehistory from Putin's perspective. So there are three events, which you discuss. The three events I'm thinking of where Putin saw perceived potential interference by the United States in his domestic affairs was the election in the 1990s of Yeltsin, where the United States, through I think overt means, gave a lot of support and arranged a lot of support for Yeltsin. I think it was 2010 or 11, I can't remember, the protests after the legislative elections in Russia, which really annoyed him. And he blamed on Hillary Clinton at the time and said it was interference by the State Department. And then the doxing operation, the Panama Papers, which he attributed to the agency, I think, or to the United States, but which I don't think there was any evidence for, at least that I've seen. So how much did those events, do you think, just briefly to discuss those, and how much do you think they shaped what happened in 2016?
Sure. So, and this is a very important question, because I think a myth out there is that Russia's 2016 operation existed and happened because of Donald Trump. And that doesn't actually line up at all with the historical record. So in terms of the points that you outlined, I would go back a bit further, and folks have written about this as well. But I think the first real formative experience for Putin was when he was stationed in Dresden as a KGB officer. And there was a popular uprising in East Germany that undid the East German government. And he writes, or he spoke about in interviews in 2000 in a book that was published very passionately about his frustration when that was happening, that these rioters, you know, they're out of control and no one from Moscow was responding and helping us. This feeling of desperation where things that were so stable suddenly became so unstable. You then extend that through not only the case of Yeltsin, but the case of Milosevic, his fall, which the U.S. had overtly sought to achieve through Iraq, through Libya, where strongmen who seemed to be in control, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, suddenly were out of power. And for someone like Vladimir Putin, who wants to remain in power and also runs a corrupt state that enriches himself, there's a natural fear that you're vulnerable, that you can be toppled, that you can be thrown out of government by your own people who would demand a more genuine, or really just at all, just any real system of democracy. So he sees U.S. actions there, which leads to a paranoia, which makes sense for someone who came up with the KGB, who's, you know, kind of all lifelong foe, the CIA, that either the CIA or just the U.S. at large will try to stage some sort of uprising against him. And that gets to the second key point that you raise, which is the 2011 election, where there were U.S. democracy promotion organizations in Russia, as well as an election monitoring organization that the U.S. had funded that was reporting irregularities in the 2011 vote. And this is at a critical moment for Putin because he's not on the ballot at that time, but he's about to be to start a third term as president, which he had previously been constitutionally or just been unable to do. So this is when Putin's really trying to make a move against Russian democracy. There are irregularities in the parliamentary elections, protests start, and then Hillary Clinton voices support for the protesters. And as you said, this is speculation, or it might not be, because this is from the CIA station chief in Russia at the time and from the deputy director of CIA at the time. And I don't know what their sources were in Russia, but perhaps this isn't just speculation. They actually had insight into it. But what they told me is that what Putin saw at that exact moment was the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, seeking to undermine his government and seeking to start some sort of, you know, revolution in Russia, which is something that he, again, going back to Dresden, had come up just sort of instinctively both fearing and opposing and resenting the U.S. for, in various cases, supporting movements for democracy. So that happens. After that, the relationship between Putin and Clinton, which had already been tense, deteriorates. I interviewed Hillary Clinton, and she told me that over the next few times that she saw him, one time he wouldn't even speak to her at first. Another time she sort of pointedly said to him, "I didn't start those protests. That was your people, not me." So very confrontational. And that matters, because what you see in the history of covert electoral interference is that personalities really matter. Khrushchev targeted Nixon in 1960 because he hated Nixon, because Nixon embarrassed him during what was called the Kitchen Debate, where Nixon and him debated about the merits of capitalism and communism, and it caused Khrushchev to just seethe with resentment. So it was personal. And for Putin, it was personal. Where in 2014, he initiated the operation to interfere in the American election in 2016, before Donald Trump had announced, knowing that Hillary Clinton was likely to be the Democratic nominee, and also seeking to sow discord within American society. So that was sort of a, I guess, a combination of two histories, one being the long road of KGB operations to interfere in elections, intersecting with that personal history of Putin and Clinton's relationship. And that then converged in 2014, where you see Russia starting to target electoral infrastructure, spread social media propaganda using the IRA, and by 2015, penetrating the networks of the DNC. And only then does Donald Trump announce that he's running for president, which causes Russia's operation to evolve in terms of its objectives and perhaps in terms of its intensity, though that's something that we just can't know, whether Putin would have proceeded as aggressively had someone other than Trump won the nomination. But the road to this operation stretches far, far back. And for someone like Putin, it seems, I mean, you know, based on what John Brennan and Jim Clapper and others told me who would have real insights into this, there was a deep, deep animus of Clinton that was very much colored by his fear of the maintenance of his power and that his people might seek to move against him if given sort of the right circumstances in which they could do so.
Two other things stood out to me, both of which have been reported, but you give it a lot more detail and you have people on the record talking about this. One was the extent to which people in the intelligence community anyway, I think it was Petraeus, Panetta, and Morrell, I might have that wrong, thought that Putin may have been emboldened because, especially in his second term, President Obama had become more dovish. They viewed the red line flip on Syria as maybe showing that the United States wouldn't react aggressively to an operation like this. But the thing that really struck me, and I guess I knew this because people have said it, was how pervasive the assumption was that Hillary was going to win and how much that informed the Obama administration's hesitation to react early against the Russians. Are those both right?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I actually would argue that the Clinton strength wasn't as determinative as has been presented or sort of accepted publicly, but I'll start with your first.
So wait, let's start with that one. So you think I overstated the extent to which you said that they were, I just got the perception that several times in the book, you quoted people saying we didn't really want to react back too hard because we thought that it could get worse for us and we thought she was going to win or something like that.
Exactly. But I think, but the thing that was more important was the idea of, I think there was sort of a built-in expectation that she was going to win. It wasn't an explicit, Hillary's going to win, so it'll all be fine, so we could just sort of.
No. Yeah.
I didn't mean that. But rather making decisions with the underlying assumption that where we were headed was Donald Trump saying on election night 2016, the election was rigged against me. So in that sense, I think it was important and essential to understanding Obama's decision making. But perhaps the more important thing that I really try to get at in the book, which is really important, especially heading into 2020, is the interplay in 2016 between two types of covert electoral interference. Because what Putin did was he launched a massive influence operation with stolen emails and with social media propaganda, the first of which was well understood in the U.S. government at the time, the second of which was largely overlooked in the U.S. government at the time. But in conjunction with those two things, the GRU, Russian military intelligence, also aggressively targeted America's electoral infrastructure, our voting systems, our voter registration databases, of which the U.S. government was also aware at the time. So what happened in the summer and fall of 2016 was that President Obama and his advisors had to make a calculation, which was Russia has released these DNC emails. However, we also assess that Russia could escalate its operation toward disrupting the vote, toward manipulating voter data, toward altering tallies, toward sowing chaos on election day, and therefore delegitimizing the election itself. And I mean, it overriding almost doesn't even fully capture the objective in the White House in that period, based on my interviews with 26 of Obama's closest advisors, is that they just had to prevent that sort of election day cyber attack. And that the emails were seen as unfortunate, but as you said, perhaps because there was an expectation that it didn't really matter, it was acceptable given the circumstances, whereas an election day attack was unacceptable. So everything that the Obama administration did in the summer and fall of 2016 has to be understood and can only be understood through that threat of vote alterations. That's why Obama warned Putin, which has been written about, and said, you know, as one advisor put it, don't fuck with us. He was referring or we'll take you down. And that was referring to an attack on our voting systems, why they worked with DHS to solidify our electoral infrastructure because of such an attack, why he approached congressional leadership about a statement regarding our election infrastructure, again, about such an attack. So that was what they were worried about. And the thing that makes this, whether it was intentional or not of Putin, that's what makes this a real achievement, is he made it so that he basically wasn't punished at all until after the election for influencing millions upon millions of American voters, which is the tradition of covert electoral interference. You know, there are rare instances of altering votes, like in Eastern Europe in the immediate post-war period, or the targeting of Ukrainian electoral systems in 2014. But really, this is a tradition of manipulating minds. And Russia did that throughout our country for months. And through the threat of another type of interference of disrupting the voting process, through reports that, you know, Michael Daniel, the cybersecurity coordinator in the White House, told me he was getting daily reports in August of intrusions and penetrations into our electoral infrastructure. It was coming in on a ceaseless basis that captivated and ultimately froze our government as Russia's influence campaign was raging. So that to me is the most essential sort of lens through which to understand what happened in our government in that time. And then there were assumptions that also mattered there, which is that their worst case scenario was that Russia would sabotage voter databases on election day, throw our country into chaos because people wouldn't be able to vote. Trump would lose. He would say it was rigged. He would point to anonymous discrepancies because Russia's hand would be hidden in saying, you know, the election was rigged against me, and sort of turn the country against the result and thereby delegitimize our democratic process, which is Putin's objective. So the assumption there was that Trump was going to lose.
Yeah. So listen, I completely agree that, and this is something I didn't fully understand until I read the book, even though one kind of knew about this because Obama threatened Putin, I think, in September of 2016. But the extent to which the Russians, I'm just summarizing what you just said, had penetrated the, you know, the electoral operations itself, and that the threat was that they were going to do something on election day on like that, that is really, that fear of escalation is the main thing that paralyzed them. And then it was, you know, they thought that that was the evil to be avoided rather than trying to stand up to Putin earlier, exactly. on the assumption that Hillary was probably going to win. So I have to say, the book, it left me rather depressed because you basically paint a picture of 100-year-old Russian tactics that have suddenly become much more powerful because of the internet and social media. And whereas before the rise of the internet and social media, they weren't terribly successful in doing this, that after the rise of social media, they're much more effective in doing this. You also describe the United States as unilaterally pushing back from this. So we're at a disadvantage in third countries if the Russians are doing this in democratic elections. And you also make clear, and you can correct any of this I get wrong, that, you know, we really, and you quote a lot of people from the intelligence community saying, we really haven't begun to solve this problem. It's not clear it's a solvable problem. Lenin and Putin both understood that competitive elections are penetratable, but now they know how to do it. And it could have been much worse, as you said, in 2016, and it may be much worse in 2020 because we really haven't fixed the problem. So is there any reason why we shouldn't be really discouraged about the future of American democracy because of your book?
So, yeah, no, that's definitely a big question. I mean, I think there's also a reason for hope, though, which is that many of the democracies that were the victims of these sorts of operations at scale, like Italy or like Japan, they've remained democracies since. I think in terms of short and long term, I am rather depressed about the prospects for a systemic comprehensive policy response to this threat between now and November, because the current president obviously has solicited rather than sought to deter foreign interference in our elections, which is an enormous problem to our national security, not to our politics, just to the sovereignty of our own country. However, as I map out in the conclusion, I do believe that there are steps our country can take with leadership from the president, but also with buy-in from citizens, social media companies, the Congress, and the media, that would substantially reduce the efficacy, the effectiveness of these operations. Do I think we can make it so they don't happen at all? I don't think that's feasible, but my argument is that if we recognize that Putin's seeking to corrupt and tear down our democracy, that if we therefore renew our democracy at home, but also abroad in seeking to defend on a coalition basis against this threat, we could see real progress. So I think it'll take leadership. I think it'll be hard. I don't think there's any easy solution here, but I do think there are things we can be doing and should be doing, instructed by the past, as I detail in my book, that would help us make a lot of progress moving forward.
You do lay out a roadmap. You have 10 suggestions at the end. And I found them a little bit hopeful, and especially in light of, so let's say Trump is gone from the scene and it's 2021. We still have a deeply, as you called it, I think, entrenched polarization in the country. And it's getting worse by the day, it seems to me. And we still have social media being used for massively disrupting our democracy, just if you consider just in the domestic context in terms of misinformation, weaponization, polarization, and the like. So I found, you know, that fact combined with the extent to which foreign adversaries, probably not only Putin, although he's probably best at it, but the extent to which the internet empowers foreign adversaries in screwing around with our electoral process. I mean, it's good for you to be hopeful, and I hope you're right, but I came away being not very hopeful.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes good sense. I mean, I think the number one thing that needs to be corrected as soon as possible, and I wish that President Trump would have done this, but it is very disorienting for a public to be told that this matters by one party and it doesn't matter by another political party, because when there's no history here, which is part of why I wrote this book to provide that history, but when there's only one example of this in 2016 that people are aware of and they're told it's a partisan issue, that is extraordinarily detrimental to our ability as a nation to respond to this threat, because it requires the buy-in of the nation. But I hope that if there were, for example, a President Biden, that maybe at that stage there could be that course correction to identify this as a threat to our national sovereignty, and from there launching a response where you're both just trying to get our democracy to work better, but also having social media companies, and they have been taking steps, but juicing those steps up with more transparency, more public-private cooperation, and also, by the way, with congressional legislation, with folks in the media being a bit more responsible and focusing more on the source of stolen materials rather than their contents, as various reporters said they now wish they had. And then citizens not letting themselves be played, because, you know, in France in 2017, Emmanuel Macron's emails were hacked and released, and it barely registered because people saw what happened to us in our country and said, we don't want to get played and manipulated like those Americans did. So there is a way to do this there, but you just add, your country needs to care. Which is why, to me, especially as a young American, you know, I like living in a democracy. I want to live in a democracy, but that involves me and my fellow citizens saying we value our ability to choose our leaders free from foreign interference, free from covert electoral interference. So if you decide to have that attitude, I think it goes a long way writ large, and then also leadership abroad in actually imposing costs on countries that choose to engage in this type of malign behavior.
I hope you're right, David. You wrote a great book. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, socks, and whiskey glasses. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.